What is virtue? I was recently asked to speak on the topic of virtue from 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5, and there doesn't seem to be much in the Bible that specifically addresses virtue. But what is it? Why is it important? My name is Stephen Medford. I'm your host this morning for the Monday edition of Mornings for the Master. And if we look at 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5, I think we can learn a lot about virtue in looking at the Greek word and how it's used here and in other places. I was fascinated by what virtue actually means here in the Bible, what this word is, and I thought I would share that with you for these mornings with the Master. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5 starts out by saying, "But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue." So the verse starts out with two conjunctions. And when you look at conjunctions, you need to ask what's their function. And the conjunction is to join words and clauses and phrases to each other. And so when it starts out with "but also," for this very reason, we need to go back and look at what was going on in the previous verses. So starting back in verse 3, we read, "As His divine power has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of Him who called us by glory and virtue, by which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that through these you may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust." And then he says, "But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue." So verse 3 shows us that God, through His divine power, this power that only God has, no one else has this power to do this, His divine power has given us things. Here it says it has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness. So God has supplied all things, past tense, He has already done this, all things, everything pertaining to life and godliness, which means there is nothing for us to put into that which God has supplied for us. What things pertaining to life and godliness would not be included in the phrase "all things that pertain to life and godliness"? Now, we need to understand this because I think too many people, you ask them the question, "Are you going to heaven?" If they say yes, they'll say, you say, "Why are you going to heaven?" "Well, I've been baptized, I try to live a good life," and so forth. That's not why we get to heaven. And we need to understand this in our minds. The people who wrote the songs that we sing understand this. We sing, "What can wash away my sin?" And of course, sin is the reason we die. The wages of sin is death, Romans 6:23. "What can wash away my sin?" Which means, what can save us? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. So why do we answer, "Well, I've been baptized, I've lived a good life"? We sing the song, "My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness." Jesus' blood and righteousness. We sing the song, "Jesus paid it all," which means there's nothing for us to give to this. We have Christ, or God through Christ, giving us all things pertaining to life and godliness. And I fear too often we think that we are saved because we study the Bible, we obey, we worship, we pray, we've been baptized. But the reason we are saved is because God has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness. Now, when I say that, there are some people that take that too far. And they say that we don't need to do anything. I didn't say we don't need to do anything. I'm just saying God is the one that saves us and we don't save ourselves. This passage shows us that we have to do something. So I'm not saying we don't have to be baptized. I'm not saying we don't have to study or that we don't have to read. That is not at all the case. If God is going to save us, He tells us who He is going to save. And if you go down to 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10, it says, "Therefore, brethren, be even more diligent to make your call and election sure. For if you do these things, you will never stumble." So He tells us to be diligent to make the fact that God has called us and that God elects us or chooses us sure. So we have very obviously, God is the one that calls us. God is the one that saves us. God is the one that chooses us for salvation. But He tells us who He's going to choose. And we need to make sure we are part of that chosen people. We can make our calling and election sure by doing the things that are presented in this list. So God has given us all things pertaining to God, life and godliness. But He has done this, going back to verse 3, through the knowledge of Him who called us by glory and virtue. So He has done this through the knowledge of Him who called us by glory and virtue. There are many passages that show us how God saves us. Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to all them that believe, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. In James chapter 1 and verse 21, it says we need to receive with meekness the word implanted, which is able to save our souls. The word is able to save our souls, the knowledge that it has. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it talks about the gospel, verses 1 and 2. And it says, "We are saved by this gospel if we hold fast to that which we've been taught." And then in Acts chapter 11 and verse 14, Peter talking about the words to Cornelius. Cornelius was told to send for Peter, who will give you words whereby you will be saved. The word, the gospel, all this contains the knowledge that gives us all things pertaining to life and godliness. But God will not save you through His word unless you obey it. That should be obvious. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 17, in contrast to being slaves of sin, which brings forth death, it says, "Thanks be to God that you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine." So you were condemned to death in slavery to sin, but you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine, which implies you're no longer slaves of sin. You're no longer condemned to death because of sin. In 2 Thessalonians 1 and verse 8, it tells us that Christ is going to come in flaming fire, dealing out vengeance to those who do not know God and those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. In Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 9, it says that Jesus Christ is the author of eternal salvation to all them that obey Him. And then, of course, you have James chapter 2, which the last half of that chapter talks about how it takes works in order to be saved, because works complete faith. And 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 21, it says, "Seeing that in obedience to the truth you have purified your souls." By obeying the truth, we purify our souls. In John 17:17, "Sanctify them in the truth, your word is truth." And so it's through this knowledge that we have all things pertaining to life and godliness, but this knowledge is not going to do us any good if we fail to obey it. Now, as I said before, God has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness, and it is through the knowledge of Him who called us by glory and virtue. And so I'm saying here, we simply need to answer God's call. All things for life and godliness are through the knowledge of Him who called us. And this is how we answer the call. And that's why He starts out by saying, "But also for this very reason, you need to be answering this call." In Matthew chapter 22 and verse 14, it says, "Many are called, but few are chosen." So the conjunctions here. In Greek, I learned to translate one of the conjunctions as "but" and the other one as "and." And of course, but is a contrast between two things, while and is a correlation between two things. So there's a contrast here. God has supplied this. Now, this is what you need to do. But there's also a correlation. These things work hand in hand together, going the same direction. And so he says, for this very reason, because God has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness, because he has given us great and magnificent promises, because we can be partakers of the divine nature, because we can escape the corruption that is in the world through lust, verses 3 and 4, for this very reason, giving all diligence, you need to add to your faith virtue. When one looks at the Greek and the words, the verbs for giving and add to your faith virtue, giving and add, I thought it was quite interesting that both these verbs are in the aorist tense as opposed to the present tense. Now, you don't have to know much about Greek to understand what I'm going to say, and I don't want to be overburdensome. But a lot of times, I used to hear in Bible classes and in sermons that the present tense in Greek means continual action. We continue to do these things. The aorist is the different tense. It's a one-time act or an act that is viewed as an entire thing or a completed thing. A lot of times it's translated in past tense, but it's a instant in time instead of a continual thing. And so when I read that, I was perplexed because we're supposed to add to our faith virtue and to our virtue knowledge and knowledge self-control. All these things go back to the verb add, which is seemingly a one-time event. But from the context, you understand this is not a one-time event, because it says in verse 8, for if these things are yours and abound, they need to be growing. So we need to continually add these things. So why is it an aorist? Why is it viewed as an instant in time or a completed action? And I had to ask other people. I had to look it up. Why? Because we can never stop doing these things. But the aorist tense is also to be viewed as something that is urgent, something that needs to be done with eagerness, diligence, earnestness, with speed. Snap to it. Get it done now. Start right now. And so that's what's going on here. And again, you don't have to know Greek to understand that that's what's going on here, because he says, giving all diligence. Many translations translated it, make every effort. Hugo McCord translation says, spare no effort to add to your faith virtue. And we see the same word for diligence used again in verse 10. It says, therefore, brethren, be even more diligent to make your calling and election sure. I think we see the sense of urgency when you read the next few verses. In verses 12 through 15, for this reason, I will not be negligent to remind you of these things, though you know and are established in the present truth. Yes, I think it's right, as long as I am in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that I must shortly put off my tent as the Lord Jesus Christ showed me. Moreover, I will be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things after my decease. This is urgent. This is important. You need to be taking care of it now. Make sure you're doing it. This is not something we can be indifferent about or lackadaisical about. We need to be doing this, not dragging our feet. Our salvation is on the line. God has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness. God has given these precious and magnificent promises. We need to make sure we receive them. So what is it we must do? We have to add these things to our faith. I'm not going to go into all these things. Like I mentioned, I just want to talk about virtue mainly, but we will mention these other things as we talk about virtue. But we have to add these things. So our topic for today is adding virtue to our faith. We will consider this under the points. First of all, what is virtue? Secondly, why we need it? And third, how do we get it? And under the third point, we're going to quickly look at these building blocks of faith, these Christian graces that are mentioned here. So first of all, what is virtue? Bauer, which is the standard Greek lexicon, defines it as uncommon character worthy of praise. Excellence of character, exceptional civic virtue. And he translates it in this text, and to the finest character, knowledge. So he calls it here the finest character. He goes on to say that it can be used for a manifestation of divine power or a miracle. The Greek word is arete, and it's the concept in ancient Greek that simply means excellence. Excellence of any kind. The term also applies to moral virtue. It is used of excellence that was usually bound up with the idea of fulfillment of a purpose. Having your highest potential being reached. The ancient Greeks used it for the excellence of a chimney, the excellence of a bull for breeding. It was used as for the excellence of the land, like the richest land, to produce crops. It was used of the excellence of a man. And of course, all these things are excellent in different ways for different purposes. Even when you're talking about the excellence of a man, you could have the excellence of an athlete as compared to the excellence of a warrior, and it would mean different things. So its root literally means excellence, and it's the same root that gives us the word aristocrat, which are supposedly the most excellent in society. In the New Testament, it only occurs four times. Once it's used by Paul, and the other three times it's used by Peter. And we already read two of them here. It's used in verse 3 and verse 5 that we're noticing. The time that it's used by Paul is in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, which I think is a verse that is familiar to us. Philippians 4 verse 8 says, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue or excellence, if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." So in that passage, we don't really have much context as to what this virtue is. We understand it's something good that we need to be thinking about. In these two passages that we've already looked at, 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 5, we don't really have much context telling us exactly more of what this virtue is. And the other time it's used by Peter is in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, which I'm going to save for a little bit later in the lesson. If we're looking at how the Bible defines this word and what the Bible uses it as, I thought it was interesting. The New Testament doesn't really give us much context as to what it means. We know that it's a good trait. We know that it's something that God has. We know that He is praised for it. We know that we should have it and we should develop it in our lives. But it doesn't tell us what it is. And so I looked at the Septuagint. The Septuagint is simply the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And in the Septuagint, and by the way, this is the translation that the Bible quotes, that Jesus used, that the apostles used. And so this would give them an understanding of what this word is as well. The Septuagint, it's used six times in the Septuagint. But it seems to be only reserved for God. We're not going to look at all these passages, but most of them. Isaiah 42 verse 8, Isaiah 42 12, Isaiah 43 21, Isaiah 63 verse 7, Habakkuk 3 and verse 3, and Zechariah 6 and verse 13. And it's usually translated as praises in most translations that I looked at. The only exception is usually in the Zechariah 6:13 passage, where the King James translates it majesty and the New King James translates it glory. So looking at the Septuagint, the way it's used in the Septuagint was interesting to me. I thought I learned a lot. Two things struck me about the way this excellence is used in the Septuagint. The first one is how it's used in Hebrew parallelism. You know that in Hebrew, they didn't rhyme words, but they rhymed thoughts. And a lot of times, Hebrew poetry and the Psalms and the prophets and so forth, many Bible translations will have it where you can tell it's poetry. It's not written in paragraphs, it's written in stanzas. And they'll often say something, and then they'll turn around and say the same thing in different words. And so they tell you one thought, and then they turn around and tell you the same thought using different words, and it kind of helps clarify the thought. Well, notice how this word is paralleled in poetry in the Hebrew. First of all, in Isaiah chapter 42 and verse 8, it says, "I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to graven images." Most of the time, this word is translated praise, arete, that we're talking about. And so here, this praise is paralleled with glory. My glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to graven images. We have the same thing in verse 12 of Isaiah 42. "Give glory to the Lord and declare his praises to the coastlands." And so again, it's paralleled with glory. Again, in Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 3, God comes from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. "His glory covers the heavens and his praise fills the earth." So again, we have the idea of glory and praise. So it's paralleled with glory. When you think about arete, it's someone who is glorious, something that is praiseworthy, taking you back to what Bauer said, how he defined it, unusual character worthy of praise. This is glory. So we're to add to our faith glory, something that is truly excellent. The second thing that struck me when I looked at how this was used in Hebrew was that it's not God's greatness in certain aspects that show his excellence or his glory here. It's something that is unique that God has. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. His power to create or to do miracles or to manifest his strength by asserting his dominance by force or something like that. These things make God glorious, but the way the word is used is not talking about these things. No doubt, for instance, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork, Psalm 19. But this is not where we mainly read about God's excellence, his arete. It could be, but it's not used in that way. I think about Psalm 139 and verse 14. "I praise God because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." We could talk about how magnificent the heavens and the universe are and what power it took to create it, what intelligence it took to create it. We can talk about the design of the human body and the design of the natural world. It's amazing. We see God's power and his intelligence, but this is not where we read about the word arete. This is not how we see his excellence and his glory that is worthy of praise. It is in the context of his doing good and being merciful and loving those who do not deserve to be loved. If I understand the word correctly, all these things about the greatness of God declare God's glory, but his willingness to forgive and to love and to bless those that don't deserve it. That is where we see God's excellence. The context of Isaiah 42 and verse 7, which we've already read, or sorry, verse 8, we already read, but in verse 7, it says, to open the eyes of the blind, to bring the prisoners out from the dungeon, those who sit in darkness from the house of imprisonment. And before, it's talking about the prophecy of Christ and how gentle he is, how much good he does when we're not worthy of it. And then it goes on to say, I am the Lord, that is my name. My glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to graven images, because of the things God does for us. In Isaiah 43, in verse 21, he mentions, this people that I formed for myself, they shall declare my praise. He mentions forming this people for himself, not because of their goodness, not because of their deserving it, but he forms these people. He created Israel and purchased them and called them by his name for himself so that they would declare his praise, his excellence. In another context, Isaiah chapter 63 and verse 7, there's a context here, and I believe this is a prophecy of Jesus. You have one coming who's covered in red, and they ask, you know, where are you from? And he said he looked around and saw no one to help. So he went out, and he defeated the enemy. When there was no one to help, when we were helpless, when we were ungodly, I think about Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. We were ungodly, not wanting to please God. We were helpless. We were sinners. We were enemies, verse 10 says. And yet, Christ died for us. He defeated the enemy for us. When we were undeserving, when we didn't want it, when we didn't care about it. And it's in this context, it says, Isaiah 63 and verse 7, I will mention the loving kindness of the Lord, the praises or the excellence of the Lord, according to all that the Lord has benefited for us, and the great good to the house of Israel, by which he benefited them, according to his mercies, according to the multitude of his loving kindness. God shows his greatness by his power, but he shows his excellence by the fact that he loves us. He continues to love us. He continues to forgive us. And I told you I was going to go back to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, which says, we are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that for this purpose, that you may proclaim the praises or the excellence of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We were in darkness. We were nobody. We didn't deserve anything. But now we are a chosen generation by his doing. We are a royal priesthood by his doing. We are a holy nation by his doing. We are his special people. Why? To show God's excellence, that we might declare God's excellence. This is where we see the excellence of God. This is what true virtue and excellence is. Not showing how powerful you are in a race, as an athlete, or whatever, but showing your goodness toward mankind. So as we consider this word in the text particularly of 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5, we think about this excellence that we add to our faith. I'm going to say in this context of 2 Peter 1, the word simply means excellence, virtue, and it's the idea of we are determining ourselves to be the most excellent we can be by doing in every situation that which is most excellent. We want to be the best we can be by doing the best we can. That's what I believe this virtue is that we're trying to add to our faith. It's this great desire to be the best. Not the best compared to other people, but living up to our potential, being the best we can be. So now we're going to look at why we want virtue. Well, from the text of 2 Peter chapter 1, I think it's easy to see why we want virtue. We need it to be saved. Verse 4 talks about how we can be like God and receive His great, precious promises. We can have His nature on us. Verse 8 says we can be useful and fruitful if we add this to our life. Verse 10 says we make our calling and election sure. Verse 11 says we can have an abundant entrance into the eternal kingdom. All these things are wonderful reasons that we need virtue to be saved, to lay up treasures in heaven. But beyond these things, I think from a practical standpoint, of course we want it to be saved, but we want it to have the most excellent life here as possible. In order to have the most excellent life for us here as possible, we have to be the most excellent we can be. When I look back at my life, I have regrets. Some of those regrets were due to the fact that I knew better. I knew what God wanted me to do, but I chose to do something different that was wrong. It was what I wanted to do. And I end up regretting that. Some of those regrets are from things that I did out of pure ignorance. I didn't know what was best. I didn't know what was right at the time. And I did it, and I have a regret. Some of those regrets were due to the fact I was simply absent-minded. I knew what was right. I thought I was doing what was right, but maybe I had forgotten some things about the situation, or I simply just made the wrong decision. Sometimes I could add this to it. I wasn't as careful as I should have been. And I would put that all in with a lack of experience. But many of the regrets, if not all the regrets that I have, could have been avoided if I had determined beforehand that in every situation I was going to strive to do that which was most excellent. That's virtue. I would have fewer regrets in my life, if not no regrets, if I had predetermined to do that which was most excellent in my life. So in order to have the most excellent life here as possible, we seek to add virtue to our life, to our faith. But not only that, in order to have the best life in eternity as possible, which is kind of what I already said when I looked at the passage, but verse 11 says an abundant entrance into the eternal kingdom will be given to us. We're not going to be getting in just by the skin of our teeth, as Job said, but we are going to have an abundant entrance. I think about Matthew chapter 6 and verse 20 often when it talks about laying up treasures in heaven. If we constantly seek to do what is best in our life, we're going to have the best life here, but we're also going to have the best life in eternity as possible. We're going to lay up many treasures in heaven by doing that which is best here. But not only that, we want the best life for our friends and loved ones as possible. Those we care about, don't we want what's best for them? Well, we can do that if we make the best choices in our life. You know, sometimes it's hard to see what Jesus would do in certain situations because we have to study to know that. We have to be very familiar with the Bible, with the Word of God. But it's easy to see what other people do. And a lot of times people need an example. They need someone they can look to. So we need to strive to have virtue, excellence in our life for the sake of other people around them, to give them an example and to be ready and available to help them not only get to heaven, but have an abundant entrance into heaven as well. I think about passages like Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16, which talks about letting our light so shine before men that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven. We can cause others to glorify God, and involved in that, I would think, help them get to heaven. Those who are glorifying God are going to be on the track to heaven. And the last thing I have on why we desire to have this excellence, this virtue, is because we want to save as many souls as possible. That kind of sounds like what I just had. But before I was looking at our friends and family, setting them an example. But now, we have to show excellence in our life for the sake of the lost souls around us. Those that are not Christians. Christians at the time of the first century, when this was written, when 1st and 2nd Peter were written, they were going through horrible persecution. It was hard to be a Christian, but they were told to keep their behavior excellent among the Gentiles so that in nothing they could be slandered. In things that they were telling them or accusing them of, in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12, and also in verse 15, they were to keep their behavior excellent among the Gentiles so that the things which they were accused of as evildoers, they would be put to silence. They knew they weren't doing these things wrong. And they would even glorify God in the day of visitation, which I think they could save their soul. I think about 1 Peter 3:15. They would be asking for the hope. Why they have such great hope? Because they're living such great lives in the face of persecution. They were doing what was right and good. Displaying the hope that they have of getting to heaven by not forsaking Jesus Christ. And so these are reasons that we want to add virtue to our faith and virtue to our lives. For my last point, I want us to look at how we can get virtue. If you think about each one of these building blocks of faith that we see in this list in verses 5 through 7 of 2 Peter chapter 1, I believe each one grows out of and helps the one before it. No one of them stands alone, and I think that's obvious. We don't complete faith, work on faith until we get it complete, and then we work on virtue until we get it complete. But each of them all have to go together. If these qualities are in you and they are abounding, verse 8, all of them have to be there together. But then he does say you add to your faith. So faith is present and you add this to it. And then virtue is present and you add knowledge to it. And so we have both things going on here. All of them are present together, but each one builds upon the one before it. And as I said, I believe each one grows out of and helps complete the one before it. None of them stand alone, and certain Christians may be stronger in some points than in other points, but they all come together and grow together into each other and from each other, and it is a beautiful harmony when you have all these things together. And I would say each one gets a little harder to possess and control, maybe, to master, I suppose. The word that's translated add or supply is a very interesting word in the Greek. It literally means to lead a chorus. The leader of the chorus would supply the chorus with the needed things. He would lead them. He would conduct them. He would supply them with everything that they needed. And some people suggest that it should be translated to lavishly supply, because the chorus or the choir was upper class entertainment, and people would sometimes spend up to 3,000 days' wages on the performance. And so it was all made for this grand performance. And so when we add, we supply these things, we want to lavish them. We want to make it a grand performance. The chorus could exist without these contributions and without the conductor, but this made them much better. Faith could exist without these things, but it would not be complete. It could be so much better. Grow into a grand performance, as opposed to maybe children picking up instruments and just playing them at random, not having ever been taught. I think you can obviously see the difference. So once we believe in God, Once we have faith, we understand what he has done to save our souls, and we desire to obey him because of this faith, we naturally want to do good. That's what obeying him is, wanting to please him. And that's virtue. That's this excellence. So you see, this virtue grows out of faith. But in order to do that which is good and that which is most excellent, we need to acquire knowledge. And so you see how wanting to do what's right naturally leads to acquiring knowledge. Once we desire to do that which is right, that which is according to God's law and to please him, we desire to do good, we have this knowledge, now we simply need to do it. And so we practice self-control, or temperance, as some translations say. We make ourselves do now what we know. And once we make ourselves do that which is good, we must continually make ourselves do that which is good. And therefore, we have to add to our faith patience or perseverance, endurance. We have to keep on keeping on doing that which is good. And our patience would run out. We would get tired of doing what's good if we had no motivation. And so we add to our perseverance godliness. And some people don't understand what godliness is. It's not godlikeness, but it is a overwhelming desire to please God. It is a reverence for God, a piety toward God, some translations say. So it is wanting to please God. If we get our joy out of pleasing God, that will keep us keeping on. And then we grow into not only trying to do that which is right and that which is pleasing to God, but we start going the extra mile and we add in brotherly love. We have this affection for all of God's people and we start trying to please them. And then to top it all off, we then are willing to go the extra mile for all people. And we become more and more godlike in all these things, having the nature of God, as we saw back in verses 3 and 4. We are willing to sacrifice our desires and our well-being to accomplish what is truly great for others. And that's what agape love is. That's what tops off this entire list of these Christian graces, these building blocks of faith. So if we have said that it's true that these graces grow out of the one before and are completed by the one that comes after, there are things that we can learn from what comes before virtue and what comes after virtue. Of course, what comes before virtue is faith. And there are two things that I think from faith that will help us develop virtue. And I'm using virtue here as a desire to greatly please God, to do the best we can be. I thought it was interesting. Some translations or commentaries say this word means moral courage. And at first, you might think, well, moral courage doesn't have anything to do with excellence. But as you think about the application, it's pretty much the same thing. Desiring to do what's right, moral courage, it takes courage to do that which is right. We want to do what's right instead of what we want. It takes courage to trust our lives to someone else and to give our lives to them instead of doing what we want. And you can think about that more, especially in the first century. To do that which was right often meant you were going to be imprisoned. You were going to lose loved ones. You were going to lose your possessions, as we see throughout the Bible and especially as we look out in history. But moral courage or doing what's right comes from believing in God. Two things about faith that I think are important here for this moral courage, this virtue, this excellence, if you really want excellence in your life. First of all, you need to trust God. I think that's what faith really is. I don't know if anyone in the Old Testament explains excellence more than Daniel. Daniel, to me, is an amazing person. But even his three friends, they trusted God. They wanted to please God no matter what the outcome was. They knew God's way was the best, and they were going to stick with it no matter what. And so in chapter 3, we have Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, serving God, trusting God. They say, our God is able to deliver us, but even if he doesn't, we're still not going to bow down and serve your gods. And they're thrown into the fiery furnace. No matter what the outcome, they were going to do that which was best. And of course, God saves them. In Daniel chapter 6, we have Daniel here displaying an excellent spirit. An excellent spirit was found in him. We see in the first part of Daniel 6. And he trusted in his God and he was saved. Now, in the New Testament, I think, of course, Christ is the greatest example of this trusting in God, this faith, which caused him to always do that which was most excellent in life. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 23, it simply says that he entrusted himself to the one who's able to judge righteously. He trusted God. And so no matter what happened in life, he was going to do that which God wanted him to do. And he was going to trust God for the outcome. In order for us to develop this moral excellence, this great desire to do that which is best, that which is most excellent in our life and everything, which is that which God would want us to do, we need to trust that God's way is the best way. I think that's obvious. If we believe God is smarter than us, then let's do what he says. If we believe God has ultimate control of the outcome of every situation, let's do what he says. Let's trust God. If we believe he can lay up treasures for us in heaven, let's do that. That will cause us to desire to do that which is most excellent in every situation. Let's trust God for the outcome of everything. The second thing I want to say about faith is that we need to dream big. To me, this is natural. If we want to accomplish greatness, if we want to truly be great and be most excellent, to live up to our full potential, we need to reach out. We need to dream big. We need to do something that is worthy of praise, that is worthy of God saying, well done, good and faithful servant. And this is a part of faith as well. We would never think to move a mountain if we didn't have faith or dream big to do so. You remember in Matthew 17 and verse 20, the apostles are wondering why they couldn't cast out a demon. And he tells them they didn't have enough faith. They had to have this faith. And he said, if you just had a little faith, you could tell this mountain to move, and it would. We see the same thing in 21:21, Matthew 21:21. Jesus saying the same illustration again. When the fig tree withered, the apostles are amazed. And he says, look, you can do great things too. You just got to have the faith. You've got to dream big. Now, when I say dream big, and even when Jesus talks about moving mountains, I'm not so sure that he's going to say, tell this mountain to move and it's just going to jump up and move. But Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 3 says, a dream comes through a multitude of business. But you wouldn't continue the multitude of business if you never think the dream is going to be accomplished. In Romans chapter 8, in verse 24, it talks about how we're saved by hope. We hope that heaven is coming. We have this assurance of heaven, and therefore we remain faithful to get to our goal. And the same thing is true with our dreams. If we dream big, if we trust God that great things can be accomplished, this will cause us to have a multitude of business. We will keep on working to accomplish that dream. And that way we can be that which is most excellent. We can serve God. We can do things that are worthy of praise. And then in order for this virtue to be completed, it has to start with dreaming big and trusting God. And then to be completed, of course, you have to add the things that complete it, that come later. This knowledge, self-control, perseverance. Once you have this excellence, this great desire for excellence, do it. Live it out. Do that which is right. For the purpose of this word in its context, as I've said before, I think in order to develop excellence, all you have to do is really desire it. resolve yourself that you're going to truly start living for God. You're going to start seeking that which is most excellent in every situation. 2 Peter is a letter. I think this is interesting. It's a letter that warns us against false teachers. If you were asking me what 2 Peter about, I would say it's warnings of false teachers. But he starts out by commanding us to grow in all these Christian graces, as if to say the best defense against false teachers is a good offense for the truth. If we are continually filling our lives with the truth that God desires, there will never be room for false ideas to enter. If we are constantly seeking to do that which is best, we're never going to fall into sin. We will never stumble. Our capacity for knowledge will grow as we learn and as we continue to fill that capacity with the knowledge of truth, which we need to, because if there's a vacuum, it's going to suck in other things. We need to constantly be filled with the knowledge and be filled with the activity of applying that knowledge and developing virtue in our lives. Do you know what God wants you to do now? Are there commands of God that you have not obeyed? Have you repented truly of your sin? Have you confessed Christ as your Lord? Have you put him on in baptism? Are there commands of God that you're not obeying now? Forgiving your brother as you should. Loving one another as you should. Treating family members the way you should. Your spouse. Your husband. Respecting your husband. Loving your wife. Are you abstaining from evil the way you should? Evangelizing the way you should. Growing in Christ the way you should. We need to be diligent, eager. Salvation is on the line, and you can't drag your feet. With all diligence, we need to be making sure we do these things right now. We need to be adding these things to our life. Make sure you are wanting to do that which is right, and then you're seeking to do that which is right. Living it out in your life. I hope you have enjoyed this lesson. I have enjoyed making it. I think it was a great lesson. I've learned a lot from it, and I hope you have too. As we conclude, I want to encourage you to always do that which is right. I hope this lesson has been an encouragement to you. If you'd like to contact us for any reason, you can call us at 1-844-367-8476, or you can email us at mornings@tgrn.org, or you can email me, Stephen@tgrn.org. That's Steven@tgrn.org. If we can assist you in any way, we would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening.